The Science Inside Podcast.
This is The Science Inside.
Welcome to The Science Inside, where we bring you the latest news, stories and events happening in the world of science and tech. Good evening. I am Siyabonga Mota. Tonight, we will be talking to you about the controversial and highly contested National Health Insurance Bill, also known as the NHI, that was approved by the Minister of Health, Dr. Zweli Mkhize, earlier in July of this year. The NHI Bill lays the foundation for providing mandatory health care service in South Africa by sharing available money for all who need access to quality and affordable health care. The right to health care is enshrined in the South African Constitution of 1996, and the National Department of Health has proposed to pursue this goal through implementation of a national health insurance. The World Health Organization calls it the universal health coverage, and it is a funding model which is utilized in many other countries. It is essentially a financing system designed to pool funds from various sources. Many financing systems in the middle income countries are fraught with duplication and inefficiencies. Crumbling of health system also often impedes on consistent policies, focus and incentives for efficiency on both risk pooling and purchasing grounds. While the majority of the population in South Africa cannot afford private health care and most access public health care and already congested and understaffed public sector, which is or contributes to slower and even less responsive services. But some of the reasons behind the pushback is the setting of this 500 billion rand fund aimed at state capture inquiries following funds mismanagement at Eskom, the SABC and other state-owned enterprises. People are concerned about the corruption, and that is already rampant in the public healthcare sector. Policymakers and ordinary people on the street want to know who is going to fund it and how it will be managed, considering that many of the state-owned entities' financial status is in tatters and highly corrupt. The NHI program will be implemented through three phases over a period of 5 years each. Phase one commenced in 2012 and was completed in 2017. The first phase of the NHI program did not involve developing new funding arrangements for healthcare in South Africa, but rather piloted various health system strengthening interventions focuses on the primary health care level. 10 primary health care interventions in pilot districts were set up to develop and refine the NHI-related policies through their feedback. We'll be having more on the NHI a bit later on the show, but later on Unscience we'll talk about, and later on we'll hear a story on how a similar financing system in the UK called the National Insurance for Healthcare Excellency, also known as the NICE. We'll also hear about how it was set up, also how it is working and so far, and perhaps some key lessons we can learn from them. But remember to be in touch with us on social media, on Facebook, Voice of It in Bracket, also on Twitter at VowFM. Use the hashtag Science.
This week's Science Headline.
The podcast is up on iTunes and at vets.journalism.co.za/science. But for now, it is the news with Lindo Kuhle Dimakwe.
Good evening, I am Lindo Kuhle Dimakwe. In your news making headlines this week, STEM fields need more women in positions of power in order for them to thrive, and our first human ancestors' fossils reinforce the idea that breast milk is still best. Reports suggest that though women have made important, significant contributions to science throughout history, they have consistently been underrepresented at all levels. Data from New York Stem Cell Foundation's NYSCF Initiative on Women in Science and Engineering, IWISE, which was a four-year study of institutional report cards, indicates that although a growing number of women are in training in the sciences, efforts to promote and maintain women in more senior scientific roles are still largely inadequate. In a study reported in the journal Cell STEM last week, researchers reported that insufficient policies were put in place to support women in science throughout their careers. Radiation oncologist and director of the Center for Bioethics and Social Sciences and Medicine at the University of Michigan, Reshma Jaxi, adds that the data suggests that we are making headway, though many institutions still only have a few women in senior positions at most faculties. In addition to this, she said in certain areas, plenty of room remains for improvement, including the representation of women in certain roles. Over 1,200 report cards, which were part of a 2014 NYSCF project, put forward a number of strategies aimed at helping to achieve gender parity in science, technology, engineering, and math were submitted. The paper represents 541 institutions from 38 countries in North America and Europe, and over 700 of the total report cards, some included in multiple years. Investigators found that although women made up more than half of the population among undergraduate, graduate, and postgraduate students, the picture became different as seniority increased. Women made up 42% of assistant professors, 34% of associate professors, and 23% of full professors. These rates varied greatly by institution. These findings suggest that the primary issue is not recruiting of women into STEM roles, but retaining them and promoting them into positions that are more influential. Jaxi explained that funding are in a unique position to require institutional leaders to pay attention to equity, diversity, and inclusion with their organizations by requiring report cards to promote action. Researchers will also look at other factors that may influence the recruitment and retention of women scientists, such as the presence of women in top leadership roles, the rates at which tenured women stay in their positions, and equity in salaries across gender, race, and ethnicity. The next phase of IWISE will focus on highlighting best practices undertaken by institutions. This will provide comparative data and allow the researchers to monitor progress over time. And our final story, a team of scientists led by the University of Bristol, UK, and Lyon, France, have discovered that the first humans significantly breastfed their infants for longer periods than their contemporary relatives. By analysing the fossilised teeth of some of our most ancient ancestors, scientists have discovered that the first humans significantly breastfed their infants for longer periods than their contemporary relatives. The results provide insight into the practice of weaning that remains otherwise unseen in fossil records. The team sampled minute amounts for nearly 40 fossilized teeth of our South African fossil relatives, early Homo, Paranthropus, and Robotus, and Australopithecus africanus. They measured the proportions of their stable calcium elements in tooth enamel, which are a function of the mother milk intake by infants. By reconstructing the age at tooth enamel development, the findings show that early Homo offspring were best breastfed in significant proportions up to the age of 3 to 4 years. According to the scientists, this might have played a role in the apparition of traits that are specific to the human lineage, such as the brain development. In contrast, infants of the Paranthropus robustus that became extinct around 1 million years ago, as well as infants of the Australopithecus africanus, stopped shrinking sizable proportions of breast milk in the course of the first months of life. These differences in nursing behaviors likely come up with major changes in the social structures of groups, as well as the time between the birth of one child and the birth of the next. University of Bristol School of Earth Sciences lead authors in the study, Dr. Theo Takil, stated that a number of factors compromise or after the health of the offspring, such as the duration of breastfeeding, age at non-milk food introduction, and at the end of sucking, differs among modern members of the hominid family. This would include humans and modern great apes, orangutan, gorillas, chimpanzees, and bonobos. The development of such behavioral differences likely played a big role in the evolution of the members of human lineage, being associated with, for instance, with the size and structure of social groups, brain development, or demography. The findings emphasize the need for further exploration of calcium stables, isotopes, compositions in fossil record in order to understand the co-evolution of weaning practices with other traits such as brain size or social behaviors. However, little evidence collected from millions of years of fossils, which do not give enough insight into behavioral changes. Recapping your stories this week, STEM fields need more women in positions of power in order for them to thrive, and our first human ancestors' fossils reinforce the idea that breast milk is still best. This week's news was sourced from Science Daily. Next up, we have to find out more about the NHI and how it will be implemented from Sasha Stevenson from Section 27 after this.
This week's Science Headline. This is the Science Inside.
Welcome back. You're still with the Science Inside. Earlier on, I spoke about the National Health Insurance Bill and all the things that people are concerned about in its implementation. On the line right now, we are joined by Sasha Stevenson, who is the head of the health at Section 27. Her focus areas are the National Health Insurance Bill, access to healthcare services in rural parts of the country, specifically speaking at Eastern Cape and Mpumalanga, and access of emergency medical services, among others. Good evening and a very warm welcome to the Science Insight, Sasha.
Good evening. Thank you.
So now let's begin with this. How the NHI is going to be implemented, phase two. How is the phase two going to be implemented when you're looking at the process of the health facilities between now and 2022? Because yet it has not been addressed, and depending dysfunction within the health system. Here we're talking about the high medical aid premium and the very poor services. How is this going to work?
So it's quite difficult to say at this stage. What does seem clear from the bill is that the first step, really, in implementation of the bill will be the development of a National Health Insurance Fund. And that fund eventually will be the fund through which all money for healthcare services flows. So that fund will be able to get money from Treasury, which is, you know, tax money, the way all departments get funding, and it will then buy healthcare services for anybody who's registered, and that anyone in South Africa or anyone who's South African and a few other categories of people will almost automatically be members of the NHI, and so that's the long term intention. What's not so clear is how the transition to NHI will work. So what the bill does say is that it'll start with the purchase of services for particular populations, so focusing in rural areas, focusing on services for elderly people and for children and for people with disabilities. So that's the idea. But what we don't know is what kind of services will be covered under NHI, how will that service package roll out. We don't know how the accreditation of health facilities will work, because the idea is that public and private health facilities should be able to be accredited and then provide services to anybody, but we just don't know how that'll work yet.
Yeah.
So really, the gist is that there is some promise in the system, and that it is supposed to ensure that all health resources are available to everyone who needs it on the basis of need, not ability to pay. But some of the details remain quite hazy at this stage.
So now, Sasha, the South African government has obviously a reputation of implementing foreign ideologies and concepts without thorough consideration. Have you ever thought about how the NHI will work and fit in South African market? I mean, given our individual needs as patients, our economy and various challenges faced by the health sector, such as shortages of drugs, obviously, and skill capacity, as well as infrastructure, to name a few.
Yeah, so I mean, I think firstly we can't call this a foreign concept necessarily. It's a concept that's been developed in line with an international idea of moving towards universal health coverage, which is supposed to ensure that everybody has access to healthcare services, and that that access is based, as I say, on need rather than ability to pay. So this isn't an implementation of the exact same system that exists elsewhere, but you do raise an important point about the ability of our system to change from the way it operates now to a completely different system. That is quite a difficult process. You know, we've now got a public health system that serves more than 80% of the population, a private health system that serves a very small minority of the population, and public and private facilities, health facilities that are in very different states and provide very different qualities of care. And so moving from that system to a system that all funding is centralized, and that services get actively purchased rather than health facilities being given a budget by the government, is quite complicated. And that's really why we need the detail of how this transition is going to work.
So now, obviously, still having this issue of pricing, we speak of public healthcare and access. Not all public hospitals and clinics, healthcare services provision is free, no. Will the NHI look into scrapping upfront admission fees at public health facilities, one or two, and how then we are going to finance these institutions, which will always have the run in its manner, considering the NHI bringing a cost-effective solution for healthcare?
Yeah, so the idea is that there should be no upfront fees for health services for anyone who's registered as a healthcare user under the fund. So those admission fees or file opening fees that you currently have to pay at public hospitals won't be payable under the National Health Insurance process. And that's certainly positive. That expands access to services. And another positive aspect is, as I say, providing access for everybody to all health facilities, whether public or private. Now, of course, there's a lot of provisos that those facilities have to be accredited, and they have to agree to take the price that government is prepared to pay them. So there'll have to be negotiation about that. But what it means is that where there's currently excess capacity in a hospital, where, for example, 40% of the time a hospital bed or an ICU bed in a private hospital isn't occupied because there just isn't enough market, there aren't enough people using those services, government will then be able to, you know, buy that time essentially and ensure that people can use that space. So it has the potential of decreasing costs to consumers or to patients, to users of the healthcare system, and using health resources more effectively. It's just that at the moment we don't know what services will be provided, we don't know what prices will be set, and so all of that creates real uncertainty for users, yes, of the healthcare system, for provincial managers and office bearers, and indeed for people who operate hospitals and medical aids and that kind of thing.
Now, according to Stats SA, our foreign migrant population rises by 200,000 annually. And these are people who are also often will need, obviously, access to public healthcare. How is the NHI looking into planning well in advance from a financial and capacity point of view?
Well, I think that's one of the most serious problems with the NHI bill as it's currently formulated, in that what it says is that all South African citizens and permanent residents and refugees are entitled to be users of NHI. So they will be registered as users of NHI and they'll receive the same services. So that's positive for refugees. What it doesn't provide for is everybody else. So what it says is that undocumented people and even asylum seekers who are waiting adjudication of their refugee status, and some people can wait for up to 10 years or even longer for that to be decided by Home Affairs, they are only entitled to ambulance services and services for what's called notifiable conditions of public health concern. So that's things like Ebola, cholera, TB, etc. So what this excludes is services like emergency services in hospital, services for the treatment and screening and treatment for HIV, services for pregnant women. And this is a real problem from a public health perspective, because, of course, if you're not treating foreign nationals for HIV, there's a risk to South Africans. But it's also a problem because it's a regression in rights. Currently, asylum seekers and undocumented migrants from SADC states are entitled to the same treatment as South Africans. And if we're going back on that, we really are changing the way that, at least in law, we are treating and valuing people who come from other countries. So the NHI isn't so much planning better for people from other countries. It's really seeking to exclude treatment for people from other countries to a large extent, and that's a real problem.
Will it mean that at some point maybe people from other countries will be asked to pay for healthcare if they come to South Africa?
Yes. If you're not registered under NHI, then you are not entitled to any healthcare services other than those services that I mentioned in respect of asylum seekers and undocumented people. So they would have to pay in full for all healthcare services.
All right. Moving on now, obviously, we are well aware that South Africa has a disease burden of tuberculosis, diabetes, heart disease, and HIV in that order. Considering these diseases burdening our health system, will other not prioritize or cover, or be covered rather, by some medical aid or the public sector be covered in the bill? And what about the prevalent ones?
Again, we don't know. There's no detail in the bill as to what kind of services or disease groups will be covered. The theory behind universal health coverage is that a country should start really at the most basic services and at primary health care level. So ordinarily, when countries try and roll out these kinds of programs, they start with a very small set of healthcare services that may include things like screenings, the services of community health workers, that kind of thing, and then expand depending on budget and depending on how they're able to roll out the program. But it's not clear at the moment what services will be included within NHI, so it's very difficult to speculate as to whether there'll be an increase in available services or a decrease.
You know, one of the burning issues here would be, obviously, South Africa is one is known as, I mean, we've been talking about corruption left, right and center. And, I mean, how do we make sure that the bill is well managed when you talk about not to be in a corruption state, and also that good quality healthcare is provided and maintained, and obviously that the funds are well managed. So if we're talking about corruption, how do we make sure that we're not in a position where this bill would be in a state of being, looted or corruption activities taking place?
Yeah, so that's, of course, a big risk, and there are certain things that you can do to try and minimize that risk. So the first thing that we see a problem in relation to possible mismanagement of the NHI fund is the process for appointment of the board members of the fund. At the moment, it's all very centralized to the minister. He or she makes a lot of decisions on appointments, on removals, on dissolving the board, etc. He also decides on appointment of the CEO of the fund. That, we think, is too centralized, and there's a need to make those appointment processes more transparent, more public, and therefore to make the board more accountable. So there are ways of doing that just in the structure of the fund and its governance. And that really is very important, because a lot of the problems that we've seen in, for example, state-owned entities and other structures within South Africa come from deficits in that governance, in the governance sphere. So that's important. But of course, having a good board and having a good CEO isn't a surefire solution to preventing any mismanagement of funds. And so anti-corruption measures would need to be built into the structures of the NHI fund. There's a very vague mention of that in the bill, but much more detail is really needed, because, as you say, this fund will need to well, South Africa will need to trust the fund.
Yes.
And I think South Africans are quite jaded in relation to these kind of entities. We really need to be assured that there are processes and measures in place to protect healthcare funding, because the way that NHI envisages it is that all funding will be sitting in one pool. And so there really is a need to put both governance and other measures in place to ensure the money is retained appropriately. And then in relation to the quality of healthcare services, the idea is that the Office of Health Standards Compliance that exists currently will have to assess all health facilities and make sure that they comply with certain basic norms and standards. And they've already been doing that, and most facilities don't currently comply with those norms and standards, so they would need to improve, and we don't really know how that's meant to happen. And then there needs to be an accreditation process, which is also about norms and standards, but mainly about ensuring that the facilities have the right kind of human resources and that they have the right systems in place, that they're able to collect data, and that they will accept the prices that government's giving them. So that's the way that it's intended that quality and kind of standardization of healthcare services and healthcare facilities will be ensured under NHI.
You know, many people say that the bill will only benefit rich South Africans. Would you say that is correct?
I don't think so, no. I think the intention of the bill is certainly not to benefit rich South Africans. It's to treat all South Africans the same. Whether that comes off is remains to be seen. But I think that there is real potential benefit for poor South Africans, for people who are currently using a healthcare system that is in large parts dysfunctional and that is underfunded, but where funds are also mismanaged and services and the quality of services is inappropriately monitored. NHI is supposed to ensure that people can use health facilities across the public and private sector. It's supposed to ensure that quality really is monitored. And so I think if we can get some issues with the bill and the structure of the fund and that kind of thing and population coverage, right, national health insurance has the potential to benefit poor South Africans, I think more than rich South Africans, and indeed to benefit the country as a whole, because health is investing in the health of a population is an investment in that population. It's important for the economy. It has a real multiplier effect. When people are healthy, when health systems are functioning, when people are employed within the health sector, that's good for people, and it can be good for the economy as a whole. So we need to see health as an investment, and we need to see equity in health as a benefit to poor people, but also to the country as a whole.
All right, Sasha, before I let you go, can you please tell me about the developments that we can look forward to with regards to cutting unregulated high medical aid costs and obviously the access to medication at pharmacies?
Okay, so the Competition Commission has for the last few years been looking at the private health sector and trying to determine whether there are anti-competitive components to the private health sector. And one of the things they've been looking at is the cost of medical aid. Not that they haven't been looking at the cost of medicine, but they've been looking at the price of medical aid and the price of private healthcare services. And the final report of the Competition Commission's Health Market Inquiry is going to be released at the end of this month, at the end of September. And that commission, the preliminary report suggests that they've made some really important recommendations about ways to bring down the cost of and improve competition in private health. So I think that's a really important development, and it'll be vital that those recommendations are in fact implemented, because even though we are intending to move towards NHI and for health services to be available across the board, public and private health services to be available across the board, there's still a need to deal with some of the high prices in the private sector, at least in the interim, and to make sure that users of private healthcare services aren't continuously squeezed out of that sector and into a public sector that doesn't have the capacity to care for them as well as the rest of the population.
Sasha, thank you very much for joining us tonight right here on The Science Insight.
Sure, thank you.
That was Sasha Stevenson, an attorney and head of the health at Health Section 27, speaking to us about the rolling out of the NHI and what it could possibly look like in for South Africans. So you are still tuned into The Science Insight right here on VAR FM 88.1. Remember, you can find us on Facebook, Voice of Earth in brackets, and Twitter at VAR FM. Use the hashtag The Science Insight. Up next, we are going to The Unscience, where we'll find out about eating fast food only diet can send you to an early death. Later on, it is the show. Stay tuned. We return after the break.
You're listening to The Science Inside, bringing you science around major news events.
Okay, welcome back on The Science Inside. It's time for Unscience, where we're looking at the stranger side of research, and we take a peek at what scientists spend a lot of time on money. Today's Unscience was produced by Bridget Liberi.
Unusual, unlikely, Unscience.
So, an extreme case of fussy or picky eating has caused a young patient's blindness, according to a new case report. So now researchers from University of Bristol who examined the case recommend clinicians to consider nutritional optic neurotherapy in any patients with unexplained vision symptoms and poor diet, regardless of their BMI, to avoid permanent vision loss.
Okay, that sounds, difficult for me. I mean, how is it possible?
Well, the nutritional optic neurotherapy is basically a dysfunction of the optic nerve, which is important for vision. So in earlier stages, the condition is reversible but left untreated. It can lead to permanent, structural damage to the optic nerve and sometimes blindness.
Wow. So would you include other food groups being included in the diet? This was just a study only based on strict or a junk food diet?
Well, researchers concluded that the patient's junk food diet and limited intake of nutritional vitamins and minerals did, result in the onset of nutritional optic neurotherapy. So I do reckon that it was a mixture of all foods, but the majority of the diet was mostly junk. The researcher suggested that the condition could become more prevalent in the future, also given the widespread consumption of junk food at the expense of more nutritious options. And also the rising popularity of veganism, if the vegan diet is not supplemented appropriately to prevent vitamin B12 deficiency.
Chocolate chip cookie important to me. Ah,
boy. All right. I see. So even the consumption of anything alone, even though it might be healthy, may not necessarily be good for you. That's what you're saying.
Basically, that's precisely it. In developed places like the UK, the most common causes of nutritional optic neurotherapy are bowel problems or drugs that do interfere with the absorption of various important nutrients that are from the stomach.
So basically, you mean countries with good quality of food have less dietary effects, but in other countries it may be different because of environmental issues, poverty, wars, and other factors linked to malnutrition. I mean, let me just ask this. So you're saying that might lead to a higher rate of nutritional optic neurofatigue?
Correct. So the clinician from the Bristol Medical School and the Bristol Eye Hospital examined the case of a teenage patient who initially visited his general practitioner complaining of, general tiredness. So the link between his nutritional status and vision was not picked up until much later. And by then, his vision was already impaired and it had already become permanent.
Okay, that's very deep. So, I mean, the truth is that old age adage is that too much of anything, even if it's good, or is it true?
Aside from being a fussy eater, the patient had a normal BMI and height and no visible signs of malnutrition, and also took no medications. So the initial tests showed macrocytic anemia and low vitamin B12 levels, which were treated with vitamin B12 injections and dietary advice.
This sounds more interesting. You know, I want you to just get into it more, because now I'm a bit lost on it.
Okay, hold on to that thought. But when the patient visited the GP, you know, a year later, hearing loss and vision symptoms had developed without a cause. By the age of 17, the patient's vision had progressively worsened to the point of blindness.
Wow. Wow. I mean, I'm really confused now. I mean, so now we have to look into what we do, what we're eating, basically.
That's basically it. To further probe the indicated, further probing indicated that the patient had basically vitamin B12 deficiency, low copper and selenium levels, a high zinc level, and markedly reduced vitamin D level and bone mineral density.
That sounds more like the bulk of nutrients one needs to stay healthy. So when did his bad eating habits begin?
So apparently, according to these scientists or researchers, since the beginning of his secondary school, so he had consumed an unlimited diet of chips, crisps, white bread, and some processed pork. By the time his condition was diagnosed, it was unfortunately a bit too late.
All right, all right. I mean, okay, this looks for me interesting. Since we are talking about making healthcare accessible to all who need it, but it goes to show that even with excellent healthcare, you can never replace good eating habits and the sound of health diet.
Right on point, Dr. Siyabonga Ntuli. The study's lead author and consultant, senior lecturer in ophthalmology and Bristol Medical School, and clinical lead for neuro-ophthalmology at Bristol Eye Hospital, Dr. Denise Etten, highlighted that this peculiar case highlights the impact of diet on visual and physical health, and the fact that calorie intake and BMI are not reliable indicators of, you know, nutritional status like we always assume it is.
So for many of us who are, I mean, who swear by a high fat, salt and sugar content diet, how should we ensure we don't fall under the same dismiss then?
Okay, I'm glad that you asked that. So now basically a diet history is recommended as part of any routine clinical examination. So this would include things like asking about smoking and alcohol intake. And I'm pretty sure a healthy lifestyle would be part of the researchers' orders as well. It's unusual, it's unlikely, and science.
All right. Up next, we're going to a story where we can take away some lessons from the UK concerning the implementation of the NHI here in SA. More on that on the, after the break.
Unusual, unlikely, unscience. This is the Science Inside.
Welcome back to the Science Inside. And if you just joined us, we are midway through the show, and it is the story where we're going to hear from Professor Andrew Briggs, who holds the William R. Lindsay Chair in Health Economics at the University of Glasgow. Briggs focuses on statistical methods for cost-effective analysis, including statistical methods for estimation for parameters for cost-effectiveness models, as well as statistical analysis of cost-effective alongside clinical trials. Here, he is a world expert in this field. Towards the end of August, he delivered a lecture where he spoke about the importance of a health technology assessment process for the implementation of the NHI in South Africa. He also spoke about the National Institute of Healthcare Excellence financing system called NICE. In short, its achievements amongst other things.
Let me give you a very quick background of where I'm coming from, which is as an academic health economist, I've spent 25 years plus thinking about how we do economic evaluations, getting involved in economic evaluations. And I've been very fortunate to live through a time when the audience for our economic evaluations has changed in the UK. And that changed when, in 1999, our National Institute for Health Care and Clinical Excellence, as it's now called NICE, was introduced, and suddenly we had a decision maker in the UK who was interested in the work that we were doing, and the work that we were doing stopped being an academic exercise and became of real policy relevance. So I wanted to reflect on, mainly on NICE, because NICE is the reimbursement organisation, as we call it, the HTA body in the UK that has responsibility for making decisions as part of our National Health Service. Perhaps some of the ways in which it has been less successful and might have some lessons for a similar sort of entity that might come about here in South Africa as part of NHI. I would also reflect, though, of course, that HTA is a truly international thing. There are many other countries that have already introduced HTA processes to help support priority setting in their jurisdictions. We think of Australia as being one of the first, actually, introduced a process back in 1992, although only for new pharmaceutical products. Canada also has a process, Sweden, Norway, many of the European countries. But it goes beyond that to some of the more middle-income countries. Thailand has a health technology assessment group that's been very influential in impacting policy within Thailand. Brazil has something of a process, and so on. So there are many other countries to look through for stories, but I'll focus mainly on NICE just because it's the one organisation I have most familiarity with. Sort of reflecting on NICE as a process, I think, you know, one of the real success stories of NICE and one of the reasons why it has survived from its inception in 1999 through to the current day is that it is seen to be an autonomous organisation. It's separate from government. It's part of our National Health Service. It has a status as a special health authority making decisions on behalf of the NHS about what interventions we should cover. The other reason that I think NICE is a good beacon for HTA processes is because it covers more than just drugs and pharmaceuticals. It looks at diagnostic devices. It looks at processes of care. It covers clinical guidelines. It covers public health. And that means its broader remit, I think, speaks to one of the most important principles that HTA agencies are there to address, and that we as health economists try and get over to our audience, which is the principle of opportunity cost. We have a fixed budget for healthcare in the UK, and I suspect you have something similar here with a limited amount of resources available for healthcare. And therefore, every time we do something new, we have to think about the opportunity cost of that decision. The decisions that we are making are fair and equitable. And one of the reasons that NICE was set up back in 1999 was a perception that we had a lot of postcode prescribing in the UK because individual health boards were making their own decisions and therefore the population wasn't getting equal access to health care. And so the idea of NICE was to bring about the end to postcode prescribing by bringing in play national guidelines for what should be funded. To that end, I think they've been successful.
I think very useful. I think this idea of opportunity costs is something that we don't like to think about. Some people call it trade-offs. We shouldn't be using that word. But actually, that is what it is. And we're all making trade-offs in our daily lives with our own budgets.
I think the issue of opportunity cost has played out for us in the UK, as I suspect it might for you here, which is that you have to think not only about the things that you are actively funding, but also where the money for that is coming from. If you make a decision to use something within the health service which is new and shiny and expensive, you have to think about where money for that is coming from. And very often, and I think what we've experienced in the UK, is that while the uptake of new interventions can be fair and equitable and covered by national guidelines, the disinvestment that occurs to fund those things operates at a regional level and can be unfair and inequitable. And that's something that perhaps we haven't managed to address as much as we should have, and that's something that I think people are starting to think much more carefully about. So in terms of thinking about an HDA process, it's not, I would say, it's not just about trying to fund the new things, it's also trying to think about what you're already doing, which represents good value for money, what you're already doing, which perhaps doesn't represent such good value for money. And I know from my experience in the States that there's a lot of discussion about overuse of health services there. As you know, they have one of the most expensive health systems in the world, coupled with some of the, certainly not some of the best health outcomes. And so thinking through, using an HDA process to think through the issues around disinvestment of things that are perhaps not offering good value for money, so that you free up resources to do things that are good value for money. Because that's the ultimate opportunity cost, as the economists would call it. When you spend your money in one way, you don't get to spend it in another. And the real cost of doing that is the health benefits foregone. Perhaps paradoxically for some of you in the room, as health economists, we think about opportunity costs not in monetary terms, but in health terms. And I think that's the right way to think about opportunity costs. And I think that can be extended not just to thinking about efficiency issues, about generating as much health gain as possible, but also equity issues about making sure that that health gain is evenly spread across the population.
Andy, could you tell us a little bit in your experience about, so HTA is not just the analysis of whether it's cost-effective or certain threshold, etc., but the process by which this takes place and why that's important?
This is hugely important, and it's perhaps almost the most important thing that you can be thinking about as you enter an era where you may be considering introducing an HDA process. And again, I would argue that that's perhaps an area where NICE has been successful. And I'll put that down to a few things. I think let's start with the concept of explicitness. It's true that when you undertake an HDA process, part of the process is that you're making decisions explicitly. Those decisions may not be decisions that are universally popular, and I can tell you from UK experience, you're going to upset somebody whenever you make a decision, because there are going to be winners and there are going to be losers and perceived unfairnesses. But if you think about the process, making those decisions explicitly makes the body much more accountable compared to making decisions behind closed doors and where nobody really understands why decisions have been made. But I think NICE itself goes beyond that and actually seeks to be much more transparent than perhaps other agencies who may have a committee making an explicit process. NICE actually goes to the effort of publishing a lot of the deliberations that lead up to their decisions. One can go on the NICE website and they can track a certain paper trail of information and evidence base that led up to a decision, including notes of deliberations that the committee made. And that's all published in summary form in what NICE calls its final appraisal determination. The other part that I think has made NICE successful in terms of its process has been the inclusive nature of both the committee and people who are encouraged to engage with the committee. So the standing committee will be multidisciplinary. It will include clinical experts. It will include statistical experts. It will include health economists. It will also include patient representatives from the patient community and representatives from the lay community. So the committee itself is broad, but also those people who are called on to testify to the committee is also broad. Individual expert clinicians will be called to testify to the committee, as will patient advocacy groups.
Can I just say what my interpretation of all of this is? So right now, decisions depend, with the exception, let me say, probably of the Affordable Medicines Unit at the Department of Health, where they do have a process. I think that the issue is that many decisions get made implicitly. So should we add such and such a guideline, for example, to antenatal visits? There's no explicit process by which that takes place.
That was Prof. Andrew Briggs from the University of Glasgow talking about the importance of the health technology assessment as South Africa continues to the process for implementation for the NHI bill. The discussion here was chaired by Director of Priceless SA. So Priceless SA is priority cost-effective lessons for systems strengthening. So this one was based at Wits School for Public Health, Professor by Professor Karen Hoffman. Please stay listening. We return after this break. That was it for tonight on The Science Inside. I hope you have learned a thing or two about the National Health Insurance and that the discussion shared here have shed some light into what the bill is about. It's all about, and importantly, how it is going to affect you and what the necessary points to ponder on. Well, that was all in tonight's show. We would like to thank you as our guests featured on the show tonight, including Professor Andrew Briggs, Karen Hoffman, and of course, Sasha Stevenson. Our team behind the scene is production by Bridget Libere and obviously Lindo Kuhle Dimakwe. You can find this week's show on journalism.co.za/science. Social media, it is Facebook, Voice of Wits in brackets. Twitter is on at VowFM, hashtag Science Inside. The Science Inside is produced by the Wits Radio Academy, funded in part by the South African Department of Science and Technology. That's it from me, Siyabonga Mota. Good night.
This is the Science Inside. The Science Inside Podcast.